Senate Judiciary Committee, March 25th, 1991.
Call the committee to order, and I would like to, we have a work session on the contempt bill, which is 376, which we're going to get to, but I want a full complement of members. So let's start with... Okay, let's take a... Have we had anything on 48 before?
No, we have not. It comes to us from living resources.
So they don't have to pay any?
Do we have any sign?
We have the sign up sheet on 48. It adds...
Okay, thanks. Okay, let's take up, while we're waiting, Senate Bill 48. I'm told that Mr. Bronner is not available yet on Senate Bill 492, so let's take up 4, Senate Bill 48, which comes to us from the Human Resources Committee. Dave Edwards is here. Come on up, Dave.
Mm-hmm. Major waste of time.
Tell us about Senate Bill 48 and why you think we ought to pass it on.
Okay,
it deals
you.
With confidentiality issues, which is probably why we have it as a sub mm-hmm. here. Another one of the things that history is collecting expertise about.
Mm-hmm. Dave. Chairperson Cohen, members of the committee, my name is Dave Edwards. I'm with the Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Services Division. Senate Bill 48 was introduced at the request of the Mental Health Division to correct some technical problems within the law. The statutes as currently defined assure client confidentiality of records in public operated mental health programs. However, the Mental Health Division and the Community Mental Health Program subcontract with a number of non-public mental health service agencies. This amendment would correct that and provide client confidentiality to mental health consumers, irregardless of where they receive that service.
So the same duty to maintain confidentiality would follow those agencies that you pass the clients to? Is that an assumption we are to make here?
Chairperson Cohen, that's correct.
They would have the same duty as you do to keep confidentiality issues in terms of the medical records and the mental health records. Any questions? I recall this issue came along with Senior Services Division with various nonprofits that were doing investigations in terms of cases that had been passed on. But I somehow thought it was we may have made an amendment for a narrow segment of organizations at that time. I thought it was a while ago, but so apparently your agency was not affected by what we did. Any other comments from committee members?
Question, Senator. Sorry if I missed it. So there's no policy reason why there is a difference, why there's a distinction between the private and public.
Senator Cohen, Senator Hill, there is no policy distinction. The Mental Health Division contracts with county mental health programs who have the option of delivering services or subcontracting with private organizations. The existing statute overlooks that possibility, and in fact, about half of the services delivered in the state are delivered by other than public agencies.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
It defines
provider to include any private organization that operates as a community mental health provider. Does that necessarily mean that they have to operate under some kind of a license from a governmental agency of some sort? Can a purely private agency set itself up as a community mental health provider without any official sanctions at all? You know?
Chairperson Cohen, Senator Shoemaker, in order to advertise themselves as a public mental or as a mental health program, a license is required from the mental health division. Our staff certify those agencies who wish to receive either public funds or other insurance payments as a mental health program.
Okay, so it isn't the community word that's important, it's the mental health provider. In order to be a mental health provider, you do need a license then.
That is correct.
And it's very clear then that this amendment extends only to sanctioned, that is, licensed mental health providers.
That is correct, Senator Shoemaker.
Thank you.
Further questions or comments on Senate Bill 48? Senator Springer?
Can you tell me to what extent does your organization help people who are now covered by the law or who would be provided or covered under this new language to understand just what their duties are as far as confidentiality? Is there any effort to make sure people understand what this means and follow it?
Yes. Chairperson Cohen, Senator Springer, the Mental Health Division publishes and updates a confidentiality handbook. I brought a copy of it today. I believe it was requested by counsel. The Mental Health Division also conducts ongoing training sessions for community mental health programs and other providers on confidentiality. We frequently get telephone calls from programs, and while we do not dispense legal advice, we suggest counties may wish to use their own legal counsel, but we attempt to give some interpretation of the confidentiality statutes.
Okay. Just another quick question, if I may.
Okay.
Is there any problem out there going on, I mean, with people not observing confidentiality or too much confidentiality, or I suppose there's some balance to be struck, although I guess we tend to favor confidentiality. Is there anything we need to know?
Senator Springer, we believe this is necessary in order to protect providers and consumers of private mental health programs. We have not had major issues or problems with the confidentiality statutes as written. They are quite tight and very protective of people who seek mental health services.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One other question. The amendment also reaches any subcontractor of a community mental health provider. Could you enlighten me as to what that includes? Who might such subcontractors be, and must they also be licensed?
Yes, Senator Shoemaker, the Mental Health Division contracts with the county mental health authority. Each county then makes a decision whether the county will administer mental health programs or whether they will subcontract. For example, in Multnomah County, the county administratively operates the mental health program but subcontracts with a number of very large private nonprofit organizations. That is the case throughout the state of Oregon. Each of those agencies, if they're receiving public money or insurance funds, must be licensed by the state.
Okay, the way the statute reads, a community mental health provider can be a private organization. We've covered that in our first question. Then any subcontractor of a private community mental health provider is given the protection of the statute. And my inquiry is to who is that? You know, you're getting down several tiers. You have a subcontractor of a private organization. And do you know who that might be? And are you comfortable that there's no problem there and that those people are also licensed providers of mental health services? And
Senator Shoemaker, we have, I believe, three counties in the state where the county has opted not to operate or to manage a public mental health program. Several of the coastal counties, Clatsop, Tillamook, Columbia, and several in eastern Oregon as well, have decided that they would contract the full mental health program out to a private nonprofit organization as the local mental health authority. Those organizations may then also contract or subcontract further with a special child and family mental health provider or a group home in that region.
Now, those subcontracted agencies, must they be licensed by the state?
Yes, they must.
So then your testimony is that no subcontractor could be an unlicensed entity either?
That is correct, Senator Shoemaker.
Okay. Thanks.
Any other questions? This bill has come to us from Human Resources Committee and is up for a possible work session. So if it, at the point that the committee is comfortable with the bill, I would suggest we move it on.
Sure.
As long as we're satisfied that I think you've done a good job to answer questions.
More witnesses?
No, there's no one else signed up on this bill. Okay. Senator Hanby moves Senate Bill 48 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Call the roll, please, Kate.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Bunn. Senator Hanby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Let's move on to Senate Bill 492. Is Diane Ness here? Come on up, Diane. Frank, I still don't see Frank. Senate Bill 492 came to us from the Business Committee. Oh. It is in your black book.
Members of the committee, this bill was briefly before the committee before, but was postponed for further hearing. At that time, Tim Wood of the Attorney General's office was here and had some amendments which his office had proposed. Those have been drafted, and they appear as the 492-2 amendments.
Is Tim here now? I saw him earlier, but oh, there he is. Okay. Let's hear from you first, Diane, and then we'll call Tim up.
Members of the committee, my name is Diane Ness, and I'm the Assistant Security Director for First Interstate Bank of Oregon. I apologize for Frank not being here. I'm kind of supposed to be the color commentator. And just wanted to kind of explain to you why we think that the mail drop bill is so important. First of all, I have brought along with me today a advertisement that we found in a basically what we call an underground book publishing company. One of the books that they advertise is called How to Use Mail Drops for Privacy and Profit. According to the text, it says here that the topics cover include how to use mail drops to obtain financial privacy, the quickest and cheapest way to obtain a fake address, how you can be traced to the mail and how to avoid being traced, how to use mail drops to disappear for as long as you want, even permanently. That's the issue that we'd like to address today, especially the issue of financial privacy. We've had a number of instances at my bank, and I know at other banks here in the state, people obtaining fraudulent identification and using a mail drop address as a legitimate address to open up an account. To illustrate the point, this happened last week. We had an account that was open using mail drop address in Eugene, and checks were deposited into this account. We were able to discover that this was a fraudulent checking account. Unfortunately, however, money had been taken out of that account before we found out. We later found out that there was another account open in a different name using the same mail drop address, and we were able to stop that before checks were deposited or money was taken out. The checks that were deposited into the one account, one was a counterfeit Bank of America cashier's check for $4,500, and there were several other checks drawn on two different banks in California Interestingly enough, the two addresses on the two other checks in California was also a mail drop address. The total loss right now that we're looking at the bank is probably going to be over $10,000, and that's just one instance of a problem that we have with mail drop addresses. Before, in the other committee, we talked about another situation, a Nigerian fraud group who uses mail drop addresses quite often, and I didn't bring them along today, but we have 65 visa applications using mail drop addresses that were submitted to our visa department. Had all of those visa applications gone through and cards had been issued, the loss to the bank would have been at least $65,000. So that's why, as a bank, we feel it's very important that we have some kind of legislation dealing with mail drops. Obviously, 95% of the people that use mail drops are good, legitimate people, and we're not trying to penalize those people. In the instance of the mail drop we talked about in Eugene, I was able to talk to the owner of the mail drop, and we had sent checks to that address, asking if when those checks got there, if they could hold them for the postal inspectors, and they said, no, we can't do that, that they would have put them in the box. According to the postal inspectors, once the mail gets to the postal, to the mail drop, it is no longer covered by federal law. And so as the sender of the mail, we could legitimately get that mail back. So those are the things that we are dealing with at this point.
Okay. Frank, you want to say anything?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association.
We did just fine.
I thought she did wonderfully, and I knew that she would. I had a noon speech, and I apologize. I do have testimony that I'll not give to you, but attached to the testimony is a list of known mail drops in the area and some newspaper clippings that discuss what you've just heard. We would point out to you that it's our belief that retail merchants and others suffer more losses than we do in this area. We have reviewed the Attorney General's proposed amendments and support them.
Thank you very much. We're here to talk about the civil penalty side of it, basically, and to offer the Attorney General what I needed to hear from you is that you are willing to support, that you are supportive of the Attorney General's amendments.
Yeah.
And while Tim Wood is coming up, why don't you come on up, Tim? I'll have Ingrid discuss Section 5, which is a civil penalty section, which is why it's here. Ingrid.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is also covered by the amendments, so please refer to the second page of the Dash 2 amendments. And this is not part of Senate Bill 101 because basically this is a court action which is required to be brought by the Attorney General's office. It's not a an administrative action. It's a court action, so it's not really covered by the same.
By 101, but the amendment, but it is covered. The civil. Penalty section is Section 5 of Dash 2 amendments, which Tim is here to present. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As you recall, the changes that we proposed for Section 5 related to penalties, as the bill was currently drafted, what it allowed was that if a mail agent violated the particular statutory scheme, we could go into court and get only an injunction the first go-around. My proposal to the committee was that if we are going to be in court and someone is violating the particular statute, then allow the Attorney General in the first instance to recover a penalty. And my recommendation was to take the statutory language and include a $1,000 penalty. In addition, since we're going to be there and spending the taxpayers' money, then my proposal was to allow us to recover attorney's fees and investigative costs in the event that the Attorney General would prevail in that action. Finally, if the person does not have the message, we've gone into court, got an injunction, a fine, and the person still violates the law, we'd ask that if we come back the second time around, that we be able to recover a penalty of up to $5,000, again with attorney's fees and investigative costs.
Okay, are there questions for the amendment requester? Senator Hill, you have any comments? Anyone objecting to the dash two amendments?
May I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Mr. Wood, in section two of the bill, looking at line 13, it talks about a person, if the mail agent has reason to believe. And in the amended version of the bill, it talks about knew or should have known. Would it be appropriate possibly to say no or should know rather than knew or should have known, since we're talking about the present tense?
I think, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think we could work with either standard. When we talked about that previously, where that language comes from, I believe, is the unlawful trade practice, which has a definition of a willful violation. A willful violation of the unlawful trade practice is when a merchant knew or should have known, and I'm not sure if it's past tense or what the proper tense would be. But I'll go with whatever the committee chooses.
And Madam Chair, it was drafted in the past tense, but the violation is committed in the present tense, so it would probably be appropriate to make them consistent.
And that would be?
That would be,
direct us to the dash two.
Line 16. Thank you. 16. Line 16. It says delete has reason to believe and insert knew or should have known. I'm suggesting that the language know or should know would probably be more consistent.
So move.
Senator Hale has moved. We amend the dash two amendments to on lines 16 and 17, replacing the word knew for know, crossing out have, known, and adding the word know. Should know, actually. Should you really? Are there objections to that amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. Is that okay with you, Tim?
That's fine, Madam Chair.
Okay. Ingrid?
Madam Chair, one other matter I'd bring to the committee's attention, and Mr. Wood raised this in his written testimony. The bill does provide for a surety bond in the sum of $10,000, and the Attorney General's office is recommended against, I believe, the position. I beg your pardon, I'm incorrect. They take no position on it, but they did bring the matter to the committee's attention.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
I had a question also regarding the Section 5 of the Dash 2 Amendments, which gives the Attorney General this sort of pantheon of rights for both the violation of Section 2 and 3, and Section 3 is the surety bond. I can understand all that you said regarding a violation of the statute, but I just want to be a little more comfortable that in the surety bond situation, a failure to maintain a surety bond should and can also lead to all of these penalties and attorney's fees and costs and so forth.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, the intent is that the fines and attorney's fees and injunctive relief would apply to the mail agent failing to get a bond also.
Or maintaining a bond.
Or maintaining the bond. Okay. That's correct.
It does do that.
Okay. Anything else?
Madam Chair, I have a technical amendment suggestion. It makes it illegal to receive United States any mail. The mail agent believes the tenant has provided a fictitious name. As I read that, I thought, how about an assumed business name, which is a fictitious name? Surely you're not intending to reach that. Yet it does. And I note also that down in subsection 2, you address the situation of assumed business names, but you don't, in section 2, sub 1, make it legal to accept mail for a legally authorized fictitious name. I wonder if we shouldn't fix that.
Mr. Bronner, you want to come up and deal with this issue? Tim, you want to comment on that just as a fellow lawyer type?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think what happens there is a practical matter. If the person is using an assumed business name and the person is properly registered with the state of Oregon, then you've fulfilled you've accomplished the purpose that you, what you're trying to do is, i.e., who's using the mail agent.
Right, but we don't want a statute that on its face makes it illegal to for a company with an assumed business name to use a mail agent.
Well, I think in that case, there would not be a fictitious or false name.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association, it was certainly not our intent involve those people who legitimately have filed for an assumed business name and are operating under that name.
Okay.
I think we probably ought to make it clear.
Well, I don't know how you're going to make it clear unless you want to say illegally fictitious or false name.
Purposes of deception.
It's pretty clear everywhere else here, huh? Pardon?
How about for purposes of deception? Work that in there somewhere.
Well, then you have to plead a whole different kind of issue, which I think goes way beyond what you're going to be.
I think Jim's got it. I think Senator Hill's got it. Unregistered fictitious or false name.
Okay, well, let's go for the moment. Suggest that that's what we're going to add there on probably on line 13, and we'll take it to Legislative Council and see whether that does the job. Is that satisfactory that we're going to use unregistered there for the committee's purposes, and we'll have Ingrid talk about placement? And if that doesn't work, we'll come back and take another look at it. But for the moment, the chair would move that we amend by on line 13 of the section 2 of the bill, the first page, that we add unregistered, fictitious, or false name, and see whether that where it might be placed in order to. Mm-hmm. To technically, and we may have to add another piece of language, but we'll give that as drafting directions. Objections to that conceptual amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay. We okay on this bill then, since it's come from Jim's committee? Jim?
Yes, Madam Chair, then I would move the SB 492-2 amendments with the changes that we have already made.
Right. Senator, are there objections to Senator Hill's motion to adopt dash 2 as amended earlier? Hearing none, so ordered.
I'm sure this goes in ways and means, is that?
There was, Madam Chair, there was a request by the Attorney General's office that they go to Ways and Means, but it does not have a sensible referral at this point.
Well, let's just wait and see. I guess we can... I suggest that they can pick it up on the. They can probably pick it up on the House side, or we can make a note of it. And we'll see what that does. We'll make a note to the Senate President, I guess, if you want. But I'm over that. What's your pleasure? We don't have the power to add Ways and Means
referrals
to it. We can make a note that the Attorney General has. In testimony, thought that would be appropriate. We'll leave it up to the Senate President.
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes, I would move that we have such a letter to the Senate President informing of the request to Ways and Means and let him take it from there.
Okay. In the meantime, Senator Hill moved Senate Bill 492 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Yes.
So one way or the other. They'll pick it up, and if it goes to the floor, it will come to us with a due pass, and they can apprehend it there and send it to Ways and Means. If we want to move it from the floor to Ways and Means, we'll do that. But I would prefer to.
So, Madam Chair, move Senate Bill 492 as amended to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Senator Brockman?
Aye.
Senator Bunn?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Senator Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. We'll send a little letter along and see what they can do.
Yeah.
Okay, we have work session. Let's move to Senate Bill 376. It is the contempt bill, which was the rough amendments passed out last time. Okay. Ingrid, let's call up there. Who else is here? We've got amendments, further amendments.
That's correct.
Dash four amendments,
here.
Folks. Coming along.
Yes.
Come on up. Who's primary spokesperson today?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carl Stecker. I'm from the Oregon District Attorneys Association.
Okay, let's just move through the bill, and anybody who has a concern here at the table, yes.
Well, I did have one concern. I think COOI was limited on its facts to the punitive contempt, so I'm not sure that it applied to the remedial sanctions. For, if I recall in that case, I think it was remanded for resentencing because they imposed a determinate sentence, which was one considered to be applicable under a punitive sanction. And so I would question a wholesale revision of the definitions here as they apply to both remedial and the punitive sanctions.
Madam Chair, members of the committee might wish to look at the older cases relied on by COOI because they do arise in the remedial sanction cases as well. That same language, willful and with bad intent. I have attached two other cases here, the COOI case.
Do you have a recommendation then? On the basis of that, we've actually moved that direction. We've moved them all in. You want to take it all back now?
For me.
Okay. Let's move on. We have corporation, the question of criminal liability of corporations. That's section 2. And Ingrid, tell us, or whoever's going to be prepared to tell us what the 1A is.
Madam Chair, I'm certainly wanting to do that. Mr. Hendricks is here and drafted it. He can tell you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, section 2 is a little bit of a strange section in that it starts out with just the general statement of inherent power, and for lack of any better place to put the liability of corporations, we tucked it in a section, subsection 2 to that section. Now, is that you want to have some discussion of that section or that subsection at this point?
I want to know where you got it and what it comes from and what it includes.
Okay. Subsection 2A, B, C, are basically derived from the criminal statute on corporate liability for criminal acts. As originally drafted, this section didn't really deal too much with corporate liability for the acts of agents of corporations or officers or directors of the corporation. And in looking at how we should deal with that, it appeared that since the criminal sections already dealt with that issue and seemed to do it in a way that would be consistent with imposition of contempt penalties, we decided to basically incorporate that as those standards with a few minor changes to make it consistent with contempt. Subsection.
Anyone have any problem with that, with where it comes from and how? I think it's a pretty good resolution of it, frankly.
I just wasn't completely clear on why the need to change from the original. Have we picked up additional coverage
I think the issue was you couldn't really tell where it began and where it ended with officers, directors, or other persons in control of the corporation, and this fleshes it out more explicitly. I think that's really what it does.
Madam Chair?
Nori, yes.
And Senator Bunn, I think because the Procedure and Practice Committee had raised a question about it, and the committee's legal counsel had raised a question about whether you could hold an agent in contempt who was not actually responsible for, you know, personally responsible for or personally involved in the act, that I reviewed a case called Department of Revenue versus Carpet Warehouse, where the standard that we had meant to include clearly said that the agent had to be the one who was responsible for the act itself, not just an agent who was in control of the corporation, who could be held vicariously liable for an act by some other agent. So we tried to determine what the most appropriate way to deal with that problem was, and the criminal law on corporate officer liability certainly gave us some direction there. I have a letter from David Brewer of the Procedure and Practice Committee. I gave a copy to the committee's legal counsel that is dated March 21st, 1991, and he says, the changes made regarding liability of corporate agents make good sense to me. So I think that has clarified it, at least for the Procedure and Practice Committee members who had raised the question.
Okay. Any other comments? Senator Shoemaker, this is again a part of Dash 4 amendments. We'll move on again to doing them.
A question, which actually I was raised in a conversation I had with Ingrid, that is that it doesn't extend to shareholders who might be involved in these contemptuous conduct. Should it? Is there a good reason why shareholders are not included as those who can be held for contempt and those who can engage in conduct that leads to contempt? I mean, I'm thinking particularly of small corporations where your shareholders are often very much involved in corporate decisions, even if they're not perhaps on the board or an officer.
I don't believe that we had intended to exclude them. Certainly, if they were the person responsible for the act, and they were acting as an agent of the corporation, I think we had intended to include them, but I can see that the language, while acting in the scope of employment, may be the problem.
And of course, often maybe the corporation is acting as the agent for the shareholder.
Although someone has to make the corporation act.
I guess I would specifically suggest whether we ought to include, insert shareholders in line 13 of page 1A, so the conduct constituting contempt is engaged in, authorized, solicited, requested, commanded, or knowingly tolerated by the shareholders, board of directors, or high managerial agent. And then dropping down a couple lines on line 16, subparagraph 3, that the board of directors, shareholders, and high managerial agents shall be subject to the contempt powers of the court. I would move those amendments, hearing no argument.
Senator Hill, you want to?
Yeah, I want to be clear about why, again, we're including shareholders as a general matter. If we're concerned about if the shareholders happen to be managers of the corporation as well, then they're covered already. You know, and I guess I'm trying to understand how shareholders' conduct of the shareholders themselves even fits. I'm just not clear. So if you could explain it.
Madam Chair, I don't know if Senator Hill, I don't know if I would do it in subsection 2. That really just talks about whether or not the corporation is going to be liable I think there's no way that a shareholder can direct the corporation to do something without going through officers and directors.
That's
to some degree. I mean, the only way the shareholder can do that is by his vote or directors or officers, et cetera. Now, as far as personal liability, you know, in other words, I think the corporation's going to be liable there anyway if the corporation goes in and takes the act. Somebody's going to have to do something or not do something, and the officers direct. The corporation eventually is going to be liable. The real issue is probably in subsection 3, the personal liability of shareholders. That there's where you'd probably need to add it if you wanted to incorporate shareholder liability. And the question there would be whether or not shareholders underneath the knowingly tolerate conduct wouldn't create a problem, because I'm not sure, you know, how, I guess, if to some degree shareholders don't have control. If you're a minority one and the corporation says they're going to go ahead and do something and they make a decision, maybe that imposes some duty to... I'm not
okay,
sure.
Let's hear from...
That's a good point.
I want to mention now, I guess, since the committee, the working group, didn't really go that far, Senator Shoemaker, I'm not sure we'd want to go, I think, Dave...
Without having a chance to really think it through.
Yeah, and I think we're making headway, at least. We're not going to do the final fix on contempt this session, probably, and if there are those kinds of things that we want to... kind of come back and clean up, I think we might want to do it. If you don't mind, I just didn't move on. Other than that, any comment, further comments on that? Ingrid, we have anything? Or I guess Nora, we can get through. I had a question on fines or restitutions on page 2, but you've added that at the end of the bill in sub 4, right? So that's all taken care of.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure. Oh, you mean the revisions to 161, 685, yes,
right,
are added. There are some additional amendments, I understand, to what we have proposed in the dashboard amendment.
I'm not interested. I'm talking about what you've done, actually. Right.
Madam Chair, they do appear on page 19, so if you want to work through them in that order. In the Handy Grossed version, they included on page 19.
19, there's 19B.
No, let's just go ahead. Senator Bunn?
Okay, so page 19 encompasses
19.
What this
right.
little bit is here.
Right.
So we'll ignore this until we get...
Right. It's taken care of there, and we'll deal with it.
Sure. I had a question before we got
okay.
to that point.
Senator Bunn, and Senator Shoemaker.
On line 23 through 26 of the bill, I just had a note, a question about double jeopardy. And if someone has received, this is on page 2 of the bill, in any contempt or criminal proceedings arising out of the conduct constituting contempt, the court shall take into consideration any contempt sanctions previously imposed for the same conduct. Aren't we allowing, is there no problem there with coming in and either one of two examples, if someone slaps a judge, are you dealing with one harassment and the second contempt, or if you've got a contempt and you've dealt with a punishment and you come back and you address another punishment, is there any potential problem there with double jeopardy?
Nora?
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, this language, I believe, is either exactly or almost exactly the current statute in Chapter 33. And there is case law that says, in fact, the criminal statutes on former jeopardy do apply. And at least for punitive sanctions, we have specifically in this bill made applicable to contempt proceedings all of the protections afforded to defendants in criminal cases, except for the right to a jury trial. So the former jeopardy statutes would apply there as well. When I discussed that issue with a couple of my favorite appellate judges, because I too had the concern about whether former jeopardy was a problem. One of the considerations that they mentioned was that there are two different focuses, foci, of the sorts of proceedings you mentioned. The contempt proceeding may be to vindicate the court's authority or to restore order, and that may be a very different purpose from another contempt action, either by the district attorney to punish and deter that conduct in the future, or by a private party for remedial sanctions, and that those different purposes may then justify different actions, even though you do have to account for prior sanctions that are imposed so that you cannot punish the person twice.
So basically that's going to be taken care of in some version of case law and individual cases of contempt where they either will have gone too far or can't realize they can't punish you a second time if it's the same issue. I guess that's what I heard in layman's terms.
Yeah, well, I'm not comfortable with it, but I don't have a solution for it.
Okay. Let's, Senator Shoemaker?
On that same point, of those same lines, as I read that, I wrote in the margin, regarding court shall take into consideration any contempt sanctions previously imposed for the same conduct. I said, how? Up or down? Doesn't really tell us. And talked to Ingrid about it, and she said, well, it's intended that it would be down. That is, that you would reduce what you might, a sentence you might otherwise impose in consideration for a previous sanction. And that raised the conduct. Well, what do you mean then by the phrase "the same conduct"? The conduct can import two different incidents of the same conduct, and the second incident might lead you to impose a stiff sanction, taking into consideration that a slight sanction was imposed before for that same conduct and didn't do any good. If what we're talking about here is the same incident.
No, I don't think we are.
Well, which are we?
Any of the above. This is good. I believe this is a case where we're into judicial discretion issues. We are not likely to tie down. And in some ways, we're going to be bound by current law, and unless we, you know,
What was the intention of those who drafted the bill?
They picked it up, this current law. This is current law, and they left it as it is, basically. That's what their intention was. They sidestepped that thicky wicket, frankly. And that's what I hear from them. Dave?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that sentence is that in the chapter? The first one, the first sentence there is with respect to other sanctions or additional remedies, I think is. I'm not sure. The other one, I can't remember how that came about. That may have been based on last session's bill, to tell you the truth. It may have no more dignity than that. So unless Nori, do you know otherwise than that?
I don't. Excuse me, Madam Chair. I thought that all of the language was current, but if the second sentence is not current, it does reflect the case law that has applied the former jeopardy statutes to contempt proceedings and has said that the court cannot impose, in effect, a double sentence on a person. So to the extent that Senator Shoemaker had raised the question about whether it could reduce the sentence, that was the case law, that was the intent of applying the former jeopardy statute, so that if you had, say, a criminal prosecution for assault on a judge and a contempt proceeding for contempt of court for assaulting the judge in court, that you could not impose both the maximum criminal penalty and an additional 6 months for contempt.
Now, then if the contempt proceeding was not for that, but it was for a second incident of the defendant failing to pay support, notwithstanding a court order, is it the intention of those who drafted the bill or of the present law that the court could take into consideration a contempt sanction imposed for the first incident of failing to pay the support in deciding upon the sanction imposed for the second incident and increase the sanction for that second incident in consideration that it's a second offense?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, I think they could do that probably anyway without anything in the bill. Within the limitations that are contained in Section 9 of the Act as far as what sanctions may be imposed. There may always be some issues to whether or not it's the same contempt, the same conduct that they're talking about on the second occasion. But I think they'd always have the ability to take that into consideration. I think this language here was mainly directed at saying, and it's kind of, again, I think it was meant more as a precatory thing than anything else, if you're going to impose some sanction and there's already been a sanction imposed in an earlier proceeding for the same conduct, and by that I thought that meant
same
the
incident.
Same incident of, okay. of contempt, that you should take into account the previous sanction that's been imposed. And I really don't I don't want to take issue. I think Nori said this earlier anyway, but I really don't think they'll be able to, under constitutional law, if they impose a punitive sanction, except perhaps in a summary contempt proceeding, the only way I could see. But if they go through one of these procedures to impose a punitive sanction and impose a sanction, I think that's it as far as any subsequent criminal proceedings, any other kind of punitive for that particular conduct or incident that gave rise to that sanction. I think constitutionally they just can't do that. I think the cases are clear on that.
But if it's a remedial sanction we're talking about, then those rules don't apply. Those limitations don't apply.
That is correct, Senator Schumer. The case that may be is that the court on its own motion or otherwise says, I think that there should be a punitive sanction imposed here. They go through the proceedings, they impose the sanction. What the intent of this subsection was, as I understand it, to say, well, if you get to the point of imposing a remedial sanction
on top of a punitive sanction,
on top of that, you better take into account what you did in that punitive sanction mm-hmm. proceeding, or you should. It's precatory. It says
shall
take into consideration. Now, whatever that means.
Whatever that means. Okay.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bond.
Well, two concerns I have. The first. Is if this is dealing with remedial on top of punitive, it would seem worthwhile to state that, because I think it's confusing. But the other, I read the same conduct as meaning the same incident. But if it's read a number of ways, I think it would be worth specifying the same incident, if that's the intent, either replacing the same conduct with the same type of conduct or the same incident, but make it explicit in statute, which we're talking about. And from what I'm hearing, it's the same incident. So I would propose, at least on that part, changing that to the same incident. But I still think it's not absolutely clear. We're just dealing with remedial sanctions.
I'll set this aside and let you all figure out what you want to draft. I think, from my own perspective, I think I'm going to leave it as it is. It's fairly wide open, and the limits are basically the judges and the system that and the Constitution and the case law that's going to allow them to see whatever they can, to either, if they want to stretch the limits, and somebody's going to, they're going to be found out of. I'm happy to sort of see if you can work that through and set this piece aside, those of you who are interested in it.
Madam Chair, I think we might be inviting the same kind of court. Consideration that we saw in the Cooey case if we don't clear it up. Because if you have a situation where you have the same
I don't want
conduct,
to argue it anymore. I would say you all to go back and figure it out.
Okay.
I would say that we need to look at what's current law and what isn't current law and figure out where the case law comes to. So I would set this little issue aside, because I don't think we're going to, as far as I'm concerned, we're not going to solve it. We don't have enough information to solve it. We may do more trouble sort of inventing right here in ways that for those of us who are not doing out there in the practicing world of being judges and those who are being judged. So I want to set this aside, and I think we've heard what the committee's, at least what Senator Bunn and Senator Shoemaker's concerns are, and we'll see whether you can get any more specific kinds of things without confining it to such a degree that you effectively limit the use of contempt when it's being used for sport enforcement and for a whole range of other kinds of things. Okay?
Mr. Manager, they're going to work with...
through Ingrid to, just to gather up. We'll go back and listen to the tapes and make sure
Madam Chair,
yes,
if I may suggest still another change in a different line. Line 31 on page 2, giving private right of action. Does a party aggrieved by a contempt of court, shouldn't that be alleged contempt of court? You don't know that you've got the contempt until you've brought the action and put on your proof.
Is that what you want to do here, folks? Work group, David? I mean, I don't know where... I can't tell what you're talking about in Section 5 because I'm not familiar enough with the bill. This is remedial actions, and you're talking about initiating and receiving. See, I don't want to give a party aggrieved... I don't want somebody to go into contempt of court if there really hasn't been a contempt yet, Senator Shoemaker. And if you hook that to sub 2... I don't want them to go into court under an alleged contempt. I mean, I think they'd have to have a clear violation and a clear contempt before that aggrieved party can go do something about it.
Then, I guess then that means that the third party couldn't initiate a proceeding unless the court has already found the contempt to have occurred. Is that what's intended?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, no, because it would be almost an impossibility for the court to make such a determination before bringing the defendant to answer.
You do want alleged in there, then it's no problem.
I think that's probably the intent. We certainly had not intended that the court make a final determination on the issue. So I don't think the committee has any quarrel with that, but I'll let the DAs... Mr. Stecker, respond if that's a problem.
That's an acceptable amendment.
You want to move that amendment, Senator Shoemaker?
I will move that amendment. Line 31 should read, a party aggrieved by an alleged contempt of court.
Good. Objections to that amendment?
Well, just a question, then, Madam Chair. So anyone who alleges a contempt then is entitled to bring action?
That's, I think, what they intend, yes.
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn and Senator Shoemaker, I think anyone who alleges a contempt can move the court for an order, but that does not mean that there is sufficient information for the court to make a determination that the person should be ordered to show, should be ordered to appear on that contempt.
Well, Madam Chair, it does have to be a party aggrieved by an alleged contempt. And I don't know what they'll use to interpret that aggrieved, but if they use anything similar to the APA or something, you do have to have some interest. You have to have been harmed to some degree by the alleged contempt. It's not enough simply alleging a contempt occurred and show up in court someday. You have to have some interest in the matter.
Okay. Are there objections to Senator Shoemaker's amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay. Page 2 is a arrest warrant allowing, right? Anything further on that? Page 5, we come to the issue of if committee members want to stop along the way, or if there are work people from the work group that want to flag something, please do, because we...
Page 3, Madam Chair.
Page 3.
Again, a point of clarity. It's line 27, permitting the court to appoint... regularly licensed and practicing attorney to prosecute a contempt when a city attorney, district attorney, or attorney general won't do it. I'm sure it's implicit that this could not be the attorney for the complaining third party. But should that be explicit? I mean, you wouldn't want to permit the court to appoint the plaintiff's lawyer as the prosecuting attorney, would you?
Sorry.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, if the person who should be prosecuting it as a government prosecutor declines to do so because it's either a conflict of interest, that attorney may be representing the person being alleged to be in contempt and held to answer, or if the district attorney or other prosecutor declines for other reasons, workload or whatever, the aggrieved party's attorney may be an appropriate special prosecutor. And I think that Supreme Court case law that recognizes that there is a right, U.S. Supreme Court case law that recognizes that there may be a right to a special prosecutor, discussed that, and that a party's counsel, an aggrieved party's counsel, may be an appropriate person to serve as the prosecutor.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I certainly read Young to say just the opposite. This is United States, this is U.S. Supreme Court case, Young ex rel. Wheaton versus, and it's at 107 Supreme Court, 2124. It basically says, as I read it, that the court has the inherent power to appoint a special prosecutor if the prosecuting attorney declines to prosecute, but that it was improper for the court to appoint the party's attorney in that case, because this was a public function and it's an interference with the appearance of fairness and therefore a violation of due process to appoint that attorney. So I would read it that way.
And Madam Chair, counsel, as I recall, yes, they found it improper in that case. I am not sure that it is so broad to say that.
Okay, well,
It could never be the case.
If Senator Shoemaker, I think we can put some language in there that said it cannot be the attorney for the...